Hiya and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. My name's Brooke and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
Hi, I'm Ashwani and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
Right, hello and welcome to another edition of our Brain Injury Bites. This one I'm really excited about because we've actually got my treating clinical neuropsychologist, Russell Sheldrick. Hello, Russell.
Hi, Brooke. Good to see you. Thank you for inviting me.
Good to see you too. It's actually the first time I've seen you since before the pandemic started, so it's nice to see your face.
Yeah, you too. We've had a few conversations over the past few years, but sadly the pandemic got in the way of meeting face to face, didn't it?
Oh, no, thank you for joining. It's nice to meet you. Obviously, I haven't met you before. It would be really lovely, actually, Russell, if you could just give us a little bit of an introduction as to who you are, what you do on a day-to-day basis, etc.
My title is Consultant Clinical Neuropsychologist, which is quite a mouthful, but we're friendly people in this profession. And I work with patients who've had traumatic brain injury, brain hemorrhage patients, brain tumour patients, and a whole host of other neurological conditions. But my clinical work, probably the majority of it is one-to-one, direct work with patients and their families. But I also get involved in work with groups of patients as well. This is an area I'm getting more and more interested in, and work with relatives and carers and institutions as they seek to support patients with neurological conditions. And I have to say, it's very privileged work. You know, it really is a privilege working with people with neurological conditions. Just extremely fulfilling and satisfying to be alongside people in their recovery journey as they rebuild lives up from either injury or disease. And yeah, it can be very inspiring work.
I can imagine. I can imagine. And I guess when you're working not only with the patients themselves, but also their family members, you get a real insight into who that person was, how they've changed, but then also that journey as they begin to recover some of what was there before. That in itself must be hugely, hugely rewarding.
Yes. As I say, when he goes... Well, it's very inspiring as well. You see people taking very courageous steps and putting a lot of effort in, because invariably there are challenges in that journey. It's not always a very easy process. There are ups and downs. There are situations where you have to manage your expectations of recovery. But when it all fits into place, and we typically work not just in isolation as a profession, but with other professions alongside us. Yes, it's great to see it when it comes together.
You do wait a little while though, don't you? Because the first time I knew of you, I don't know if I can remember the first time I knew of you, because obviously after a head injury you go through a period of post-traumatic amnesia. My parents told me that because I worked in a bar at the time, I got a lot of visitors. And I think my mum was, and my dad were quite nervous about you when they first saw you, because you were in the corner of the room as these people were coming in to see me, and I kind of took over the ward with visitors, and they were thinking that you were really kind of upset with me. But you said that was really good initially to get that stimulation from your friends.
So I can remember that, Brooke. And, you know, in a ward environment, so when you first came into hospital following your traumatic brain injury, we do have to be very careful in managing the environment, not just for you as a patient, but for those around you as well. And sometimes if situations become overwhelming, there's too much noise or there's too much sort of busy activity around, people can get distressed. But we were noticing that actually that was quite motivating for you. You know, you were relating to your friends and clearly getting a bit of, I call it comfort, but just fun, but a bit of normal life interaction with those people. So yeah, it was fine to let that continue.
My question to you would be, when at one point do you get involved? Clearly you're involved on a regular basis when patients are going through the rehab ward side of things, but do you have input sooner than that whilst still in the acute phases?
I was told that you were waiting till I was out of post-traumatic amnesia.
Tricky question to answer very directly and succinctly, but here at the Manchester Centre for Clinical Neurosciences, we have neuropsychology input nearly every stage of a patient's journey. Okay, uh-huh. So very little in the A&E stage, but when a patient is admitted to the trauma ward, we have psychology input there. So that's looking at quick assessment of a person's cognitive or information processing ability, if there's any behavioural disturbance that we need to work on whilst they're in those early stages of recovery, psychology will get involved there. And sometimes there is a need for emotional support early on. So from the early, very acute stages of a person's recovery, there will be some psychology input available, and that's decided on really by the team. If they feel the treating team on the ward needs some psychology support, they will request that, and we do our best to respond. I mean, Brooke, in your case, you had moved to what we call the acute rehabilitation ward, and that's where I was working at the time. So I was the psychologist on that ward. So you and I met at a very early stage in your recovery journey. And not everywhere in the country will have acute rehabilitation wards. It's typically that you're treated either surgically or medically, and then you await a rehab bed elsewhere. Here at the Neuroscience Centre in Manchester, we try to get rehab started as soon as possible. But the evidence is, whilst the brain's in this state of flux, if we get the right amount of stimulation and, if you like, rehab exercise for that person's stage of recovery, we are perhaps speeding up their recovery, improving their chances of a better recovery. That doesn't mean that we're busy with them 24/7 on that ward. Of course, rest is very, very important in the acute stages. But we do try to get going with our physiotherapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, if necessary, and provide an environment in which people are stimulated just enough to start improving in the very early days of their either brain injury or illness.
Just to give our listeners some idea, what does neuropsychological rehab look at that early stage? Because I'm guessing it's an evolving process. So as somebody recovers and gains more function, the shape of rehab will change and the level of input. But in the early sort of acute trauma phases, when there's still so much going on, What do you do with patients?
For a lot of patients, some of it is about building insight into their condition. So some patients are in a state of unawareness about their condition, and therefore it's very hard for them to engage in tasks that they don't see as relevant. Why are you asking me to do these physical exercises? Why are you asking me to build up my independence in washing and dressing? Their insight can be compromised. And therefore, psychologists would have to work with them very sensitively to develop insight in a way which doesn't overwhelm them and cause a very negative reaction. So we have to be very emotionally sensitive, but quite firm in helping them understand why they're there, what's happened, and what our plans are. Another role is understanding their cognitive abilities. So, for example, if a physiotherapist wants to work on mobility and balance, and they're developing certain techniques to help the person improve in their mobility and balance, if they have memory difficulties, their rehab may get into a Groundhog Day kind of situation. Whereas if we understand the memory difficulties and we're working with cues to prompt a person's ability to remember key information about the exercises they have to do or the reasons why they're doing them, we've got a better chance of building up progress rather than just going back to square one. And another vital role in the early stages is normalizing people's feelings and reactions. So maybe as they develop insight, as you can imagine, that could be really upsetting. So once their life was okay, reasonably okay, and next they're told, no, you've got these problems, this has happened to you. Remember, for some people, like Brooke describes in the state of post-traumatic amnesia, they won't have any recollection of what happened to them. But as that insight builds up, then it's quite understandable that they're going to feel quite worried, quite sad, putting it mildly. And therefore, we have to provide an environment in which we are recognizing their emotions, normalizing them, and saying, yeah, of course, it's quite common to go through this. It's understandable.
I guess it's like a grieving process in some
ways. It is. It can be. It can be, yes. Yes. And obviously, a lot of uncertainty at that time. If I'm like this now, does this mean I'm going to be like this for the rest of my life? Mm-hmm. And we don't always have answers to that. What we have to say is we're working on the assumption that we can make improvements in these areas. So you have us, the team, and a health service process that is designed to help you work through some of those situations and those fears.
I can really relate to that emotional side that you said. I remember the first appointment I had with you, or the first appointment that I can remember. I remember going through this thing that I was forgetting people's names, and I was really conscious because, like, you know, people, someone would tell you the name, 2 minutes later they'd ask you the name and you'd forgotten. And I just thought everyone was perceiving that I was being really rude. I didn't realise that everybody would understand that I'd had a brain injury, and it was totally to be expected. And I remember you told me your name was Russell, and I thought, right, I'm going to remember this guy's name. And I thought, really sorry to Russell. I've got a friend called Russell. So I just imagined you as like a really over-exaggerated version of Russell. So that's what I remember. I kept thinking about that all the time. So I really made a massive effort to remember your name.
You put a smile on my face because obviously you're not the first person to have gone through that ward who would struggle with staff members' names. And, you know, I remember, again, you saying, oh, I feel as if I'm being rude and, you know, people think I don't care about them. And hopefully, well, from what you said, I was able to reassure you that that's not the case. But, I've had various versions of techniques to remember my name, including one person who was struggling to remember it. I said, well, you know, what does my name sound like? Can you come up with something that's in your imagination which will make it a bit funny or a bit odd? And it said, yes, you're the man in the crisp packet. What's that about? That's the noise a crisp packet makes, isn't it? It rustles. So that's how I remembered my name.
I then got involved with a charity that you'll know real well, Basic, which is Brain and Spinal Injury Centre in Salford, which is just down the road. And there was a lady who's unfortunately passed away now, Mary Todd, and she used to run the memory class, and she used to call herself Mary. So that's how everybody remember that. And you pick up all these little ways of remembering things to patch up these problems that you've now got.
And that's a role we as neuropsychologists have as well. We might have a few, if you like, off-the-shelf techniques which we are trained to help people with. But we're also learning from a patient who said, well, I found it really useful to use this, you know, for example, a mental image to help me remember somebody's name. Well, then we encourage other people to use those techniques as well.
I remember, like, we used to set me these, like, memory exercises, and one of them was to watch a film and start off, I mean, this is how bad it was at first, it was started off at, like, a minute. And start like a timer, start a minute and then stop it. And then you'd have to write like a synopsis of what happened in that last minute. And then you gradually increase it to 2, 3, 5, 10 minutes. And I used to get overconfident as well. And it was like the first time I went to, as a celebration of me supposedly getting my memory back, went to see the James Bond film, It was Casino Royale. And I remember my dad asking me afterwards, like, did I enjoy it? So I ain't got a clue what happened, but I did really enjoy it. Yeah. I couldn't follow a film for such a long time. And in some ways, 15 years later, I can't down now, but it's something that you definitely have to be aware of. It's lack of concentration, isn't it? But I think it's the more you practice it, the more it kind of improves. And I think something that's helped me massively for that is when I started driving, because obviously you're hyper-focused when you're driving. And driving to me was not like sitting down and doing a specific memory exercise. You're doing something that you enjoy, but you're also improving your concentration skills as well.
And I think, I mean, the exercise you told us about just there, Russell, in terms of, you know, what does my name sound like to you? Trying, you know, coming up with word association or the memory
mnemonics,
one. I think it's you know, we've talked in the past about how people with traumatic brain injuries can suffer with rigidity of thinking. So it's probably quite a useful exercise to try and encourage that sort of loosening of thought process and flexibility of thought process. Because I guess, you know, at the end of the day, we're dealing with a muscle, and it is just creating that training muscle memory.
What do you think, Russell, about the textbook claim that brain injury, well, something that I'd seen a number of times, with brain injury kind of heals for 2 years and it plateaus after that, or a maximum of 3 years. I think my personal take on that is, I guess maybe the physical healing does plateau, but I don't think you can stop making improvements. I think when I made my main improvements was after 3 years.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think those studies which people often quote are saying it's a 2-year, if you like, curve upwards for recovery. I think the most rapid period of recovery in certain basic functions takes place in the first 2 years. But there are so many other variables. You know, you think about, it was a few years after your injury, but you started talking about studies or a work situation, returning to drive. So the brain's given a lot of other challenges throughout life, isn't it? Not just in the first 2 years. And the brain has to adjust and adapt once these new challenges happen. So for those people who have got fortunate enough in having the drive to keep going and putting themselves in the way of new challenges, or having an environment, family, social situations which are constantly helping them move forward and think about what next, then, you can still have very significant recovery. What we don't know is that all the nerves and the nerve pathways grown back, or are we just developing new ways of doing things? If you like, hacks, workarounds, which the brain is extremely good at doing. A very dynamic organ. It's constantly rewiring. My brain's rewiring through doing this podcast. As I'm thinking, what should I be saying? How has this come across? You know, my nerves are firing in ways they haven't ever done before.
And we're just two seasoned professionals, aren't we?
Exactly. I'm learning.
In fairness, I think I am as well. It is that kind of constant exercise of listen to what you're hearing and then, you know, where can I go with this? And I suppose we do it on a daily basis without even thinking about it.
I think from experience, the only time I've like it stops or my recovery's gone backwards is when I've stopped, when I've kind of given up and trying, you know, stop making an effort. I think what's always been important is having something to aim for, some sort of structure to your week, and also like maintaining a good level of fitness. That's one thing I've been quite keen on all times. And also keeping that in balance as well, not trying to overwhelm yourself, because that in itself can be exhausting. And for me, when I'm tired, the dark thoughts come in and, you know, the positivity drops, and it's to be quite a depressing state.
So quite a few things, if you don't mind me picking up on there and running with Brooke. And I think you also mentioned before about mental muscle, memory muscle. This is a concept which taxes a lot of neuroscience professionals, that if we just keep practicing one specific task, are we actually building mental muscle? We may be doing, but we may simply be working out different ways of doing things within the brain, so using different strategies. So a lot of, Brooke, you might remember, I asked you to do lots of concentration tasks.
Yeah.
So these sheets of paper where you had exercises to do, like read this and circle the number of times the word "the" occurred in the text. And, you know, there's some people say that those kind of activities don't really achieve a great deal. And there's obviously been a huge industry in brain training apps, haven't there, which is training your memory or your concentration or your problem solving. And I think I would never say those things aren't useful. But sometimes I think the benefit is that people realize I've got to work on these things. It's about developing insight. So if you have a memory problem, but you're constantly working to improve your memory, it means you're more consciously improving your memory in everyday situation.
Absolutely,
so some of that memory muscle stuff is about developing, almost like accepting some of these difficulties as a part of your identity and doing something about it, you know, working a way around it.
I was going to say, I don't think I really started to get better until, or make improvements, until I'd like, after I'd accepted, or I don't know if it was acceptance or just, you know, started to understand that I had these problems that were going to hold me back. Not to say that that's stopped me doing anything, but just understanding that I've got, you know, the understanding that I've got these things that will hold me back in life. And I've got challenges to find my way around. You've just got to do things in different ways.
And you mentioned before, Brooke, about, you know, some of these challenges coming much later on. But it's always that balancing act, isn't it, of not trying to do too much.
Yeah.
And not trying to do, or not doing too little. So you gave a brilliant example of the exercises I'd encourage you to do, watching a program for a brief period of time and then sitting down and writing a summary. Yeah.
So
you're prompting your memory. And then off you went to see Casino Royale a week later. Great, you enjoyed it. And it is a great film, you know, plenty of action to enjoy. But, you know, it had been a stretch too far in terms of keeping up with the pace of the plot and the characters, etc. And one thing I think you taught me, Brooke, was how that negotiation within yourself, that sort of seesawing of I want to do more but I can't do too much, is a constant, isn't it?
Yeah,
particularly when you're ambitious, you're wanting more recovery, you wanted to do more with your life. That is fantastic that you've got that motivation and that drive, but if you overdo it, you can be left feeling a little deflated. So the analogy I always come up with recovery is the tortoise and the hare. You know, the story about the tortoise and the hare racing. And so tortoise gets the prize.
That's absolutely what I've always... And one thing you've always said to me, is be kinder to myself as well, haven't you?
Yeah.
Because I've always been quite hard on myself, probably because I've tried to do things that are unachievable, and then I give myself a really hard time that I can't do them.
Almost setting yourself up to fail.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Thank you for listening to part one. We hope you can join us for part two. Please don't forget to follow, subscribe and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.